Burning Bucks. Burning Bucks. Burning Bucks. Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of Burning Books, a podcast dedicated to discussing, celebrating, exploring, etc. Great books, very good books, books in which there's something to appreciate or admire, as well as books that are the opposite of all those things. Today, we are deep within the
50 feet of crap
category with Mordecai Richler's widely loved, well, that's what the dust jacket says, St. Urbane's Horseman. It was published in 1971, and that's probably one of the few neutral things that can be said about it. All of which is to say, get ready for a shitstorm. Music, please. The pain of reading St. Urbane's Horseman can be summed up in two words: Barney's version. Barney's version was the last novel Richler, who pronounced his name Mordecai Richler, though I'm not going to do that. It sounds like it's coming from the mouth of a strangled toad. Barney's version was the last novel Richler wrote before dying in 2001. On, yes, the advice of a friend, I read Barney's version shortly after it was published, and I really loved it. It was a book divided into three sections, one for each wife of the book's hero, Barney Panofsky, and the first section, from its very first lines, was nearly perfect.
Terry's the spur, the splinter under my fingernail. To come clean, I'm starting on this shambles that is the true story of my wasted life, violating a solemn pledge, scribbling a first book at my advanced age, as a riposte to the scurrilous charges Terry McIver has made in his forthcoming autobiography about me, my three wives, aka Barney Panofsky's Troika, the nature of my friendship with Boogie, and of course, the scandal I will carry to my grave like a humpback. Terry's Sound of Two Hands Clapping, of Time and Fevers, will shortly be launched by The Group, a government-subsidized small press rooted in Toronto that also publishes a monthly journal, The Good Earth, printed on recycled paper, you bet your life. Terry McIver and I, both Montrealers born and bred, were in Paris together in the early 50s.
The second and third sections of the novel drop the standard by increments, but as the book was flying so close to the sun to begin with, regression is understandable. If I couldn't forgive the disappointing or downright lousy parts, or even halves, of books I've read, I would have to indict Kay's Notebohm's The Following Story and Nabokov's Lolita, and I'm not going to do that. So, with the warm and fuzzies, and more importantly, high expectations, still emanating from my memory of Barney's version, I was whole hog into Richler's earlier book, St. Urbane's Horseman, which also started extremely well. It's after midnight in London, and Jacob Hirsch, who, it will be revealed, is the protagonist of the novel, has gotten up from bed. His sleep has been fitful lately. His wife's nursing a newborn, his mother has come over from Montreal to stay with the family, and on top of this, there are two other spurs, or splinters, interrupting Jacob's sleep, an ongoing trial, in which he is a defendant, and the horseman. The trial and the horseman are only alluded to in the opening chapters. The trial makes its appearances in brief and sporadic interior dialogues conducted by the protagonist.
Listen, your lordship, they're twisting everything in this courtroom. Jacob Hirsch is no sex nut. I'm a respecter of institutions. An all-around good chap. A big talker, but a chicken.
And also in bits of a screenplay that Jacob has written, which incorporate elements of the alleged sexual assault for which he is on trial, and feature bits of sadism, masochism, adultery, General Field Marshal Rommel, and Mary, though in this case called Major, Poppins. As for the eponymous horseman of St. Urbane, he appears in Jacob's waking reveries, riding over the countryside in pursuit of his elusive target, Dr. Mengele.
The doctor was reputed to keep armed bodyguards, maybe four of them. Certainly he kept a weapon handy himself, say a service revolver tucked under his pillow, or an automatic rifle leaning against the wall in his villa with the barred windows off an unmarked road in the jungle between Puerto San Vicente and the border fortress of Carlos Antonio Lopez. Even that doesn't matter, Jake thought. St. Urbane's horsemen will take him by surprise, gaining the advantage.
The reader can see that these elements, the wife, the growing family, the mother, the trial, the horseman, fit together, but it's not yet clear how. The book starts off as a mess, but an intriguing and energetic mess, the best kind. Indeed, it takes most of the first 100 pages of the book for the various elements to find their levels. Once upon a time, Kurt Vonnegut was a creative writing instructor, and one of his pieces of instruction was to start a story as close to the end as possible. In St. Urbain's Horseman, the story starts very close to the end, but as with so many novels, this is a bit of a ruse. As soon as we sense the big blow-up, the all-cast finale, lurking around the corner, we are backed up and shown how Jacob found himself in this predicament in the first place. Most of the exposition of the novel is devoted to how Harry met Sally, in this case, how Jacob met his wife, Nancy. Oil and water, they were, which, in Richler's world, translates into low-class Jewish boy, barely deracinated from the tenacious grip of old customs and baseless faith, meets, seduces, and marries upper-middle-class Protestant dame who is, quote, too good for him, unquote. To make this marriage complete, we need to know that the déclassé Jacob not only stole this girl away from her natural surroundings, he did so under the nose of his best friend, Luke, who would, by all outward signs, religion, class, etc., have been a much better match for Nancy. And how did Jacob do this? By being a smug, miserable, offensive boor. By dismissing Nancy the first time he met her, and many times after. By behaving passive-aggressively, which I understand to be every girl's turn-on. In short, by being the stereotypically bad-mannered, unworldly, slovenly, presumptive, arrogant, aggrieved, covetous, etc., 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 you get the picture. Jacob wins Nancy by being the caricature of a Jew. And Nancy, acting according to the fantasies of such hard-done-by, oppressed, shoulder-chipped Jews, and according to the fantasies of Mordecai Richler as well, falls for it. More, she lusts after it. At which point, of course, Jacob wonders why Nancy ever fell for him in the first place. A mirror of the reader's own feelings, for after the first 100 pages, whatever ingratiating qualities Jacob Hirsch may have initially possessed, these qualities have fallen entirely from view and from memory. Jacob Hirsch is scum, and the fact that the author still tolerates him doesn't mean the reader has to. And I say this not because I dislike Jacob Hirsch or find him too offensive as a protagonist. That's never a problem, and it would never be a problem. The reason I can barely tolerate Jacob Hirsch is that he commits a crime far worse than being unlikable. He's predictable. And in being predictable, he represents the most insidious quality of this novel. But we'll get back to that in a bit. Having suffered through the story of the unlikely romance of Jacob and Nancy, the reader is ready to return to the present, to when things were good in those first few chapters. Unfortunately, the author has other ideas. He wants to take us even further back in time, back to St. Urbain, the one-way, westbound-only, street in Montreal that was once the center of a certain kind of Jew, the kind from which Jacob Hirsch descended, Eastern European, formerly shtetl-dwelling and striving with various levels of success. St. Urbain is the old country in the new country. In this section of the book, the reader is exposed to the formative years of Jacob Hirsch, son of St. Urbain, streetwise scamp, lousy pitcher for his lousy high school baseball team, and angry youth who casts a crooked eye at the traditions of his family. The thing is, by this point, the reader's sick of Jacob and couldn't give two fucks about where he comes from. His ship sailed and capsized, and there were no survivors. So what we focus on instead is the rest of Jacob's family, the cousins that fit in, the cousins that didn't quite fit in, the one cousin who renounces her family and religion and all that is St. Urbain by moving to Toronto, the deadbeat father who comes and goes from the Hirsch household, and a bunch of other interchangeable family types, the Aves, the Martys, and the Lews, as well as the occasional, far too occasional for the desperate reader, mention of the fabled horseman. The horseman, as it turns out, is Jacob's cousin, Joey, and he is fabled because he flits in and out, mostly out, of Jacob's life and of the world of St. Urbain. In his broad absences and sudden appearances, the horseman tantalizes the denizens of the street and the reader with his worldliness, his exploits, his strangeness, self-consciously sowing the seeds of rumors that encircle him, and which are neither proven nor disproven.
Joey had left a skinny boy, sickly, with a rasping cough, and come back a big, broad-shouldered man. He had style, Jake recalled, such style. Striding down St. Urbain, bronzed as a lifeguard, eyes concealed behind sunglasses, trousers buckled tight against a flat, hard stomach, he did not seem to be of St. Urbain anymore. There was no suggestion in his gait that a creditor might be lurking around the corner or that a bailiff was waiting to pounce. Joey wasn't going to be tapped on the shoulder by a goy bigger than he was. People on the street took pleasure in him, but they feared him too. When he drifted past Best Grade Fruit on the day after his return, for instance, Lou waved tentatively, beckoning him inside, but he was grateful when Joey merely acknowledged the invitation and strode on. Tansky's regulars, equally wary, immediately recognized that Joey was a drinker. Joey wasn't a happy, mischievous drinker. His state wasn't born of a quick-burning little schnapps with honey cake, head tossed back and eyes instantly tearing. Joey drunk was a threatening man. The afternoon of his return, he summoned Jenny and Artie into the parlor. "Our father is alive in Toronto," he said. "He's living with an Irish woman, a widow. She owns a candy store." That was all. But another day, Artie overheard Joey and Jenny quarreling. "Where did you go when you left here?" she demanded. "Europe." "Did you get to Paris?" "Yes, I was in Hollywood, you know. I made a bad marriage with a starlet. And I'm the Queen of Siam. Now tell me why you came home. Were you in prison?" The next morning, Joey went shopping, and then the parcels began to come. Exquisite white shirts and black silk socks from the Savile Row shop on Sherbrooke Street. A sterling silver cigarette case from Burke's. A suit knot from Maury Goldenson, with padded shoulders, a two-button roll, and slightly zoot trousers, but from a tailor with an authentic British accent. Joey's taste was alien to St. Urbain. He did not favor gaily colored ties or two-tone shoes, neither did he go in for a camel hair coat. Joey dressed as cold and correct as a Westmount lawyer. The neighbors were astonished to learn that not only could Joey ride horses, but he had a commercial pilot's license. He could actually fly an airplane. They were eager to fill Joey in on all he had missed in his 6 years' absence. Zalman Fried, they told him, was an artillery officer. Cooperman's boy had joined the Navy and was serving on a corvette in the North Atlantic. Marv Bloom had been shot down over Malta, and his story was broadcast repeatedly in radio spots to promote the sale of victory bonds. "Hey, mister," the announcer said, "remember Marv Bloom, the fresh freckled kid who used to deliver your morning newspaper?" To all these stories, Joey responded with a bemused smile. "And meanwhile," he would say, "you're all making money hand over foot."
Joey, the horseman of St. Urbain, is different from the others. He is the one genuinely different character in the book, which is what makes him the one genuine character. He's the one, the only one, you want to read about, the one you want to follow or hear more from. But you don't get enough of the horseman, and in his absence, there's no one else worth caring about. Those two words, genuine character, and its noted absence, are two more that could be said to sum up the problem of this novel. The Horseman of St. Urbain, Joey Hirsch, puts the rest of the story into relief. He is the one person in this bloated cast who is not representative. Everyone else in this book, in one way or another, is. What I mean is that, with this single exception, every character in St. Urbain's Horseman is an obvious parody. Jacob is the striving Jewish boy who does good. In London, where he lives, he is surrounded by an old guard that is much like the Abes and Martys and Lous of Montreal, except richer. And because they are richer, they are crasser, as they are expected to be. Nancy, being the well-brought-up proto-Anglo from Toronto, suffers with a stiff upper lip, exactly as one would expect. Jacob's mother is a ranting, arm-flapping, warmed-over cartoon we've seen in Portnoy's Complaint and a million other places. And there's nothing she says that you don't see coming from China. In fact, there is not one character who, in the end, and often much before the end, bucks expectations. Harry, the co-defendant in Jacob's trial, initially brooks this trend. He's both proud and ashamed of being lower class. He is cunning, and he is a self-respecting pervert. But his rage, at first surprising in its intensity, becomes unidimensional. Every character is unidimensional. If this book were a stereo system, it would be one where the volume's all the way up and the knob has been broken off. There is no subtlety in this book. There are no shades. There's just a lot of unclever, uninsightful noise. Please don't get me wrong. Parody is at the heart and in the origins of the novel. The problem in St. Urbain's Horseman is we're not dealing with parody so much as parody of parody. Cellophane parody, I would call it. A good send-up, a good parody, is a dagger to the heart. It draws blood. Because as much as it is an exaggeration, it is an exaggeration of a truth. In this novel, though, the exaggerations are not of truths, but of stereotypes or caricatures, which are all exaggerations to begin with. Richler can't stab his characters in the heart because he doesn't know where it is. He couldn't find their heart if you were given a 10-foot lance and a functional MRI. His characters are as real as Elmer Fudd and Bugs Bunny. In fact, less real when you think about it. Why, Mordechai, does every old man on St. Urbain Street have to tell terrible sexual jokes? Why does every English person have to titter at the mere mention of sex? Oh, right, because they're so uptight. There is nothing advanced about this book. That's the problem. It is almost uniformly junior. With the exception of the sex scenes, which are to this novel what battle scenes are to Virgil, the only place where the narrative comes back from the dead, there is nothing past page 100 of St. Urbain's Horseman that relieves the pain of reading this book. The promise of the opening pages has been cruelly, cruelly extinguished. While suffering through the latter hundreds of pages of this book, my mind did admittedly wander from its punishment, and it occurred to me that there was a way that all this could have been avoided. And this comes courtesy of another two words, third person. This book is written in third person, and in third person, it is inexcusable to have a tale so lacking in variety, a tale where every person you meet sounds like every other person. Indeed, the narrative voice of this book is so closely fused with the thoughts and opinions of its mediocre and unimaginative protagonist that it's smacked, yes, smacked, of authorial laziness. And it's a mistake to be a lazy author, a big one. Had Richler switched from the objective third person to the subjective first person, then the dreadful limitations of this narrator would instead have become the telling shortcomings of its protagonist. Instead of laboring through this predictable plot, the reader would have been reading Jacob's story while also reading Jacob, in effect reading two stories at once. This is, after all, what made Barney's version so good. It was a version, and as you read it, you became the detective, seeing where the version might have been a cover-up, a Freudian slip, a lie. You see a whole new world, as Aladdin so aptly put it, existing behind the one presented to you by the speaker. In St. Urbain's Horseman, there is no other world, and there is nothing new in the one you're given. This experience has not ruined the novels of Mordechai Richler for me, which is to say, it hasn't ruined the warm and fuzzies that emanated from Barney's version, but it has come really close to doing so. So close that I don't want to look back at that far better novel too carefully to find that Richler was not the quick-witted wordsmith he seemed at the time to be. Audible sigh, redux. And with that expelling of air, I say thank you for listening. Next up on Burning Books will be an interview with book critic Scott Esposito, creator of Conversational Reading and The Quarterly Conversation. The book we'll be talking about was chosen by Scott. It's Rainer Maria Rilke's sole novel, The Notebooks of Malte Lauritz Brigge. Bring it. In the meantime, I look forward to your notes, nasty and nice, either via Twitter at burningbookspod or email. The address is burningbookspod@gmail.com. My thanks to Hakan Ozgan for the music.
There are several ways to thank someone. So, let's start with the easiest. Teşekkürler.
And as always, go Jays.
Hi, this is Michael.
And this is Gregorio.
And we are Michael Gregorio. We're on Litopia Radio, having a great time and a wonderful time. Our latest book is Unholy Awakening, which is published in England by Faber and...
Faber! Yes. And in US...
By St. Martin's...
Press!
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much.